do you think Hamas's end goal here, and what role does Iran play?
You know, I'm not sure Yahya Sinwar, the putative leader, military leader, the architect of the October 7 terror surge, had a real plan. I think he hoped some sort of millennial solution in which peoples of the Middle East, the axis of resistance, the Iranians, the Houthis, the Hezbollah in Lebanon, would somehow rise up and create some sort of regional conflict. If he didn't anticipate the Israeli response, the ferocity of it all, I think he should have. He spent 20 years in an Israeli prison, speaks fluent Hebrew. I'm not sure he had an end goal, frankly. Right now, as you pointed out, Rob, the leadership's been decimated. Yahya Sinwar's brother, Mohammed, perhaps, and a few brigade commanders are making the decisions. I think Hamas is going to survive and wants to survive as an insurgency. It can't govern Gaza any longer, but it will remain a force that will be able, through intimidation and co-optation, to influence whatever political arrangements are made there, and none at present look promising.
So, Aaron, you mentioned the hostages who remain in Gaza. The hostage families have publicly criticized Prime Minister Netanyahu for not doing enough to get their loved ones back. Could the U.S. and Israel try to secure a release of the hostages without a broader ceasefire?
I mean, I think it's possible, Rob, but the initial proposal called for a three-phase deal lasting 45 days, limited exchange of hostages, the women, the elderly, and the infirm in exchange for a six-week deal. Depending on Mr. Netanyahu's flexibility, which isn't all that great, and Hamas's desperation, it's possible to consider that you could get through a phase one accord. But even that's going to be very, very tough to do under these circumstances.
That's Aaron David Miller. He's a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Aaron, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
As many Americans sit down for a Thanksgiving feast today, millions are worried about where their next meal will come from.
There is no county in the United States where there's not a group of people who are living with hunger.
That's Claire Babineau-Fontenot. She's the CEO of the National Food Bank Network Feeding America. She says donations are down because there's a lack of awareness about hunger in the U.S.
During the pandemic, we as a nation really understood what was happening with hunger. We could see those long lines blocking traffic on streets or filling parking lots. And as a whole nation, we really pulled together our resources and our intentionality, and we did things to be helpful. Congress did that too. Bipartisan legislation that increased the amount of food that people had access to during the pandemic. And since the pandemic, those resources have been cut back. And foundational to the work that we do is that it must be nonpartisan, not bipartisan, but nonpartisan. And we're hopeful always that when we share what's really happening in communities across the country, that any and every administration is going to want to roll their sleeves up and be helpful too.
It's a known fact that the work that food banks do is essential. But when it comes to nutrition, how hard is it to provide nutrient-rich foods?
It's rather difficult for at least a few reasons. One, it's more expensive. And two, fresh produce, as an example, protein, dairy, requires refrigeration and requires some sophistication around the handling of it. I mentioned how vast our network is. Many of our partners don't have access to refrigeration. So part of what we do as a national organization is we actually invest in those smaller organizations and make certain that they have the refrigeration that they need. They're working hard to purchase more and more nutritionally dense food, and they're doing it that with some serious headwinds around cost and around the fact that they simply don't have the resources that they need in order to make that happen in the way they wish they could.
Claire, it's Thanksgiving, a day when families come together to share a meal. I'm wondering, is there an uptick in the number of people who come to your food banks this time of year?
Yes, and there's also typically an uptick in the number of people who give during seasons like this. Of course, for most of the people experiencing hunger in this country, it doesn't just happen during the holidays. But the holidays can be particularly challenging. My sense is it feels even worse because it separates people from these rich, wonderful traditions that they see unlocking on television and all around them, and that way too often they're not able to participate in.
Claire, there will be many people that listen to our interview and may want to give, but there will also be people who may need the services of an organization like yours. How can they find out more about that?
So both categories of people can go to the exact same place. Go to feedingamerica.org. If you're in a position to give, it's there that you can learn how to donate and how to advocate. And if you are among the 47,400,000 people in this country who are struggling to make ends meet, please go to feedingamerica.org, and there you'll find a food bank locator. Just put your zip code in there, and what will pop up is an organization that's there to help you. I hope you reach out, and I know the people in this network will want to be a great neighbor to you.
That's Claire Babineau-Fontenot. She is the CEO of Feeding America. Claire, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Pop musicians from South Korea have started to show up on the U.S. charts in recent years, but this week, Korean artists set a new record. Stephen Thompson of NPR Music explains.
On Billboard's latest albums chart, three K-pop records landed in the top 10 at the same time. That has never happened before. The boy band ATEEZ debuted at number one with Golden Hour Part 2, their sixth consecutive top 10 album. Another boy band, ENHYPEN, returns to the Billboard 200 with Romance Untold. That album debuted back in July, dropped all the way off the chart, and now returns thanks to a deluxe reissue that includes two new bonus tracks. So just say away, let them begin to die. Finally, there's a member of BTS, the granddaddy of the current wave of K-pop groups. Jin becomes the last member of BTS to hit the US top 10 with his solo album, Happy. BTS has been on a planned break, not just in order to launch solo careers for each of the group's seven members, but also so they could complete their mandatory military service in South Korea. The group is scheduled to reunite next year, so BTS is looking like one of 2025's surest bets for chart success. Stephen Thompson, NPR Music.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning, happy Thanksgiving, and thanks for being with us for Morning Edition. It is the 28th of November, and there's still lots more to get to this hour here on the program, of course. We still, let's hear about Thanksgiving movies, shall we? I know there are quite a few families that have traditions, including myself. We always watch the movie Planes, Trains, and Automobiles every single year. We'll hear about Thanksgiving movies and the tradition coming up on WPR.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb with The Splendid Table. Join us for Turkey Confidential, our annual culinary triage show for that crazy cooking day, Thanksgiving. We'll take your calls and get help from our amazing friends, Tiffany Derry, Joe Yonan, Paula Velez, and Andrea Wynn. That's Turkey Confidential today from 8 p.m.
this morning at 11 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from The Alliance, a not-for-profit cooperative committed to helping employers self-fund by providing data and insights to manage their health plans. Info is at the-alliance.org.
Support for WGTD's local news and public affairs commitment comes from Casey Family Options, a tradition of trust. For more information, including how to get started and pre-planning, visit caseyfamilyoptions.com or call 262-653-0667.
Morning edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. In weather, mostly cloudy across the state today. Could see a few flurries in the afternoon, with far northern parts of the state seeing a bit of accumulation with highs in the 20s and 30s. It's going to be really cold tonight, lows down into the teens and 20s. Tomorrow, cloudy, windy, and cold with highs in the 20s. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. From the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz. It is Thanksgiving, and for football fans, that means watching the Detroit Lions. The team has played on Thanksgiving nearly every year since 1934. That year, the Lions lost to the Chicago Bears 19-16. So it is fitting that today, 90 years later, the Lions will take on the Bears once again. Joining us to talk about how this Thanksgiving tradition was born is Bill Morris, author of The Lions Finally Roar, The Ford Family, The Detroit Lions, and The Road to Redemption in the NFL. Bill Morris, welcome to the program.
Happy Thanksgiving, Rob.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. And, you know, football, Thanksgiving, for many of us, is like turkey and stuffing. How far back does this tradition go?
Well, in Detroit, as you mentioned, it started in 1934, but back in the 19th century, when football was first invented, college teams, Yale and Princeton, played on Thanksgiving days. It wasn't a tradition like it is now, but, you know, it was a holiday, and people were off work, and people figured, well, we'll play a football game, and people will come out and see it, and indeed they did. And there were some professional games played before 1934 on Thanksgiving Day, but it was the Lions who really cemented it as a perennial event every Thanksgiving Day, beginning in 1934, the year the team moved to Detroit from Portsmouth, Ohio.
Wow. And so how did this come about? Why Detroit?
Well, when the Lions moved to Detroit, they were struggling in Ohio. You know, it was a depression. They were not drawing a lot of fans. They were playing in a little stadium on the Ohio River in Portsmouth, Ohio. So a guy named George Richards, who owned WJR Radio in Detroit, paid a little under $8,000 for the team, brought them to Detroit.
Wait a second, $8,000?
A lot of money back then. You know, this was a struggling team that was losing money. So he had to, but you know, the Detroit Tigers baseball team was very entrenched. And so he realized he needed a gimmick to attract fans to this newfangled thing called pro football. Well, he had the brilliant idea. He could put it on WJR, and WJR was an NBC affiliate, and he could get it broadcast nationwide on 94 stations. So it became a media event in 1934. It was a huge success. The game was sold out. 26,000 fans showed up at the University of Detroit football stadium. They had to turn fans away. It was a national event. You know, all over the country, people are listening to their radios, and the Lions are playing the mighty Chicago Bears in Detroit on Thanksgiving Day. So that was the beginning of a tradition that's still going 90 years later.
$8,000 for a football team. What did they pay their quarterback?
A friend of mine talked to one of the guys on that team, and he made $4,000 that year, and that was a lot of money. I mean, that was top dollar for a player back then.
Wait, he made half of what the team was worth?
Exactly. I mean, it was a fire sale deal when he brought the team to town, when George Richards brought the team in there.
So, okay, Bill, I'm going to apologize in advance to Lions fans. I am a Vikings fan, and one of my team's most memorable wins came on Thanksgiving Day in 1998 over the Cowboys back in the days of Randy Moss. What are some of the most memorable Thanksgiving football games that stand out in your mind?
Well, there's one, Rob, that is still imprinted on my eyeballs. I was 10 years old. I'm going to date myself here, but 1962,
okay.
The mighty Packers, undefeated, came to Detroit to play at Tiger Stadium. I was in the stands that day. The Lions just absolutely demolished the Packers and went out to a 26-0 lead and ended up winning 26-14. It was a much more lopsided game than that. And that game, to this day, people of a certain age in Detroit still refer to it as the Thanksgiving Day Massacre, and it was the only loss the Packers had that year. They won the championship. The Lions, as usual, finished second. But that was a memorable Thanksgiving Day. The people in Detroit are still talking about that one. Believe me.
The Thanksgiving Day Massacre.
Yeah, 1962. Everybody remembers that one.
So these days, there are three football games played on Thanksgiving, including the annual home game for the Lions and an annual home game for the Dallas Cowboys. When those other games were added, did this sort of threaten the Lions' role in this tradition?
Well, I don't think so. The Lions still have a hugely solid fan base, but even in their lean years, the fans in Detroit were always very dedicated to the Lions. And the Lions, as long as they had that home game every Thanksgiving, it didn't really matter to them, or I don't think the management or the ownership of the team, and certainly not to the fans, if Dallas had a game, say, or whatever. Dallas started playing in the 60s, and then I believe it was in 78, they got a permanent deal to always host a Thanksgiving Day game. And the Lions always kicked off first, and then the Cowboys. And then finally in the 2006, they added a third game. You know, the NFL is never shy about a chance to make money, so they jumped on it. If two is good, three's probably better, so they have a third game now. But the Lions are still locked into that home game every Thanksgiving. And there was talk a few years ago when the Lions were really in the dumps back in 2008. They went 0-16, the first team to ever lose all 16 games. And the league started talking about possibly taking the game away from Detroit because they were such a bad TV draw. But the Ford family among them, convinced the owners to leave it alone and to let the Lions continue to play on Thanksgiving Day.
So, Bill, the Lions are looking very good this year, but as I'm sure you know, despite being one of the oldest NFL teams, they have never been to a Super Bowl. Is this going to be their year?
Well, a lot of people are starting to think so. You know, they've got this wonderful record. They've got a powerful team. They've had a bunch of injuries, and they still just seem to keep chugging along. In fact, when I started writing the book, I was thinking I was writing a story about futility year after year that the Detroit Lions have experienced. And while I'm writing the book, I had to change my tune because they suddenly got good while I was writing the book. You know, my original title had been Natural Born Losers. And once they started winning, I had to come up with a new title, and that's how I wound up with the Lions Finally Roar. And they are indeed roaring, and a lot of people think they're going to go to the Super Bowl this year. I hate to predict it because, you know, Detroit fans are used to getting their hopes up and then getting knocked down, so I don't want to get my hopes up too high, but they do look awfully good right now.
Well, Bill, as a Minnesota Vikings fan, I can definitely relate. That is Bill Morris. His latest book is The Lions Finally Roar, The Ford Family, The Detroit Lions, and The Road to Redemption in the NFL. Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
This is NPR News.
Michael Kiwanuka grew up listening to grunge. He went to school to study jazz. He was raised on his parents' Ugandan rock, and his new album sounds like none of that. You only know. I'm Ari Shapiro, the British singer-songwriter on how it feels to stop trying to be cool on All Things Considered from NPR News. For
all we know. That story, plus the day's news from 3 until 6:30, today on Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is WPR News.
Good morning. Thanks so much for being here for Morning Edition. Glad to spend part of Thanksgiving with you on WPR. It's 8:29. News starts now.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. It's a snowy Thanksgiving in New England and much of the northeastern U.S. Winter storm warnings are in effect from upstate New York to Maine. The National Weather Service says several inches of snow are likely by tonight. Some places could see up to a foot of accumulation. Flight delays are reported at many airports, including ones in New York and Boston, as NPR's Tovia Smith reports.
Snow is coming down on a wide swath of northern and western New England and upstate New York, creating challenges getting to holiday dinner for many, and National Weather Service meteorologist Brett Rathbun says it may be as tricky getting back home, even after the snow tapers off.
Certainly, you know, give yourself some extra time to reach your destination, especially given the potential for some snow-covered and slippery travel. As with temperatures falling below freezing, there could be some icy spots or some black ice to form on roadways, especially if they are untreated.
On the upside, those with plans to ski this holiday weekend are thankful for the fresh snowfall. Killington Resort in Vermont is among several, saying today's snow is making for a great start to the season and enabling more trails to open over the weekend. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
Police in Northern California say speed was likely a factor in yesterday's fiery crash of a Tesla Cybertruck. Three people were killed, one person was hurt. That Cybertruck has had six safety recalls since it went on sale about a year ago. This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. A Milwaukee-based program has helped more than 350 victims of domestic violence find a foster home for their pets within the past decade. Research has shown that pets can be a barrier to people leaving a violent situation, but the program helps find a foster family for a pet for up to 60 days that can help victims leave their abusers. Carmen Petrie is the CEO and president of Sojourner Family Peace Center. She says many victims and survivors of domestic abuse will not leave a situation because they're worried about their pets. The program could be a way forward.
Survivors are isolated, hurt, and trying to find a path to healing, and animals can be a big part of that healing process.
The program is funded through grants and donations from the community. Several stores inside of the Valley View Mall in La Crosse were closed during the holiday shopping season this week because of a power outage. The La Crosse Tribune reports the interior of the mall closed at 5 p.m. on both Monday and Tuesday of this week. Some of the stores inside of the mall were able to remain open, but others were forced to close their doors just as shoppers were getting ready for the holiday season. U.S. retail sales increased about a half percentage point in October of 2024 compared to 1 year ago. That's according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Valley View had to shut down for nearly a week, also back in August, when a power outage once again left much of the mall without lights or air conditioning. Tomorrow's football game between the Wisconsin Badgers and Minnesota Golden Gophers is expected to be one of the coldest at Camp Randall Stadium in decades. That game is set to start at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. The National Weather Service says projected temperature at that time in Madison is 22 degrees, but high wind gusts could make it feel as cold as 10 degrees. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports that if those numbers hold, it would be one of the five coldest Badgers games at Camp Randall Stadium since the team started keeping track of temperatures at game time in 1950. Tomorrow's game could be the coldest played at Camp Randall since November of 1964. Coincidentally, that game also featured the Badgers hosting the Minnesota Golden Gophers. I'm Alex Crow. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz in Berlin, Germany. After Roe v. Wade was overturned, Wyoming tried to ban most abortions. Those bans have been blocked by lawsuits. And last week, a state judge ruled against the bans. The judge's reasoning rested almost entirely on language that Republicans added to the state constitution about a decade ago. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach explains.
For the past 11 months, State Judge Melissa Owens has been weighing if Wyoming's abortion bans are constitutional. Last week, she ruled they weren't. Dr. Jovanina Anthony is a women's health provider based in Jackson.
It certainly is further inspiration to continue the fight.
She was one of several advocates who sued the state to block its two abortion laws.
I just feel this wave of relief washing over me as I think about the women of this state and other states who are continuing to fight for their rights.
The basis for Judge Owens' argument goes back over a decade.
Senate will come to order.
In 2011, Wyoming lawmakers gathered on the Senate floor to talk about changing the state's constitution to oppose the Affordable Care Act. Their conversation didn't have much to do with abortion.
There's four paragraphs. First one is, each competent adult shall have the right to make his or own her health care decisions.
That's Senator Drew Perkins advocating for the amendment. Republicans didn't like the tax penalty people faced at the time for not having insurance.
And that's what this is about, my fellow senators, I think, is about choice, about whether you're going to free to choose it, whether you're free not to choose it.
The federal penalty if you don't have health insurance was eventually thrown out, but not before Wyoming voters approved the amendment. It explicitly laid out residents' rights to make health care decisions. The same happened in a handful of other states, such as Arizona and Oklahoma. That's according to Mary Ziegler, a historian and law professor at the University of California.
It's just sort of like a messaging bill, right? Where Republicans were using it to signal disapproval of the Affordable Care Act.
But Ziegler says that Wyoming's amendment has come back to bite Republicans, who now want to ban abortion. In her ruling, Judge Owens said the abortion bans violate the right to make health care decisions for an entire class of people, those who are pregnant. Ziegler says this is the first time a judge has used this legal logic. Other states are using different parts of their constitutions to protect abortion rights.
Addressing due process or equal protection or the right to life or bodily integrity.
In Wyoming, a key part of Judge Owens' ruling was that abortion is in fact health care, according to dictionary definitions and medical associations. But the state of Wyoming and anti-abortion groups disagree.
Abortion is not health care.
Marty Halverson runs the advocacy group Wyoming Right to Life.
It destroys the two-patient paradigm and allows one patient to be killed and somehow benefiting the other patient.
The state has now filed to appeal the ruling to the Wyoming Supreme Court. State officials haven't responded to a request for comment, but Governor Mark Gordon said in a press release that he's committed to defending the constitutionality of the laws and the, quote, sanctity of life. For now, abortion remains legal in Wyoming. For NPR News, I'm Hannah Merzbach in Jackson.
For many, Thanksgiving is a time for a big meal with loved ones, but family gatherings can also be tough, especially if the conversation turns to subjects where not everyone shares the same set of facts. NPR's Audrey Wynn is here with some tips from Life Kit about how to navigate table talk that turns touchy. Hey, Audrey.
Hey, Rob.
So, Audrey, I'm sure we can all think of scenarios when we feel like we want to correct something we're hearing at the table, maybe something we disagree with.
Yeah. Say your cousin thinks the government is controlling the weather with chemtrails, for example.
That's an interesting example. So in that scenario, I think I would just bite my lip. Or what's appropriate? Do we engage?
Well, choosing not to engage is a perfectly valid response. If engaging is going to put you in a situation where you feel uncomfortable or unsafe, opting out is a great choice.
Okay.
That can look like just exiting a conversation. You know, say you want to go grab more food or excuse yourself to go use the bathroom. If you want to be more direct, you can just say something like, I don't want to talk about that. But Rob, you really don't need to engage in the conversation if it feels too personal or existential. But if the thing that stops you in your tracks is a false piece of information, it could be worth engaging in if you've got the time and energy. Research shows people trust information more when it comes from sources or cultural contexts they already know.
Okay, so Audrey, I'm going to stick with this example that my cousin thinks the government is controlling the weather with chemtrails up in the sky. So if I decide to engage with my cousin on this, where do I start?
So the experts I spoke to said to set aside the idea of intervention to start. You want to begin from a place of connection, not correction. I talked to Rachel Kuo, the research facilitator of the Asian American Disinformation Table. She recommends taking time to understand why your loved one believes the misleading statement.
So often, people's memories really shape the ways that they engage in current ways with political systems and their media environments.
It's also good to remember that the goal of your conversation shouldn't be about changing someone's core beliefs. Instead, focus more on correcting the specific piece of false information.
That makes sense.
Yeah. An expert I talked to actually avoids using the term misinformation altogether because they found people often had negative reactions to the term.
Okay, Audrey. So let's say that you've got your cousin's attention. You're engaged in a conversation about this example, but maybe you're using very careful language. Now, how do you take the next step to address what you think is a misleading claim?
So when you do attempt to correct misleading information, you might think keeping it short and sweet is the move. But actually, you should provide a detailed fact check.
A detailed fact check. I don't know if I would do that naturally, but go on, please.
Here's Professor Bryony Swire-Thompson, director of the Psychology of Misinformation Lab at Northeastern University.
So that's one of the best methods that we know to correct misinformation is by not just saying this piece of misinformation is false, but providing what we call a factual alternative. So saying what is actually true.
So providing a factual alternative to this idea that chemtrails are mind-controlling people, you can let your cousin know that chemtrails are actually a misnomer. What they really are condensation trails or contrails, which form when water vapor condenses and freezes around small particles and aircraft exhaust. Some closing tips. If things are getting unproductive or you're getting stonewalled, it's all right to take a step back. And as all of the experts I spoke to said, don't expect things to change after one conversation.
That is helpful advice from NPR's Audrey Nguyen. Audrey, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And for more holiday survival tips, check out NPR's Life Kit podcast.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning and happy Thanksgiving. Thanks for spending part of it with us here at WPR. Lots more to get to this hour in the program. We're going to hear a little bit about Thanksgiving movies. I know that for some people, movies can be a big part of the Thanksgiving tradition. My family and I always used to gather together to watch a movie after the dinner. We'll hear that coming up, plus a story on the revival of Barnes & Noble, all ahead on WPR.
I'm Ira Flatow. On Science Friday, we wonder about the secrets of nature and meet the scientists finding the keys to the universe, like black hole maven Jan 11.
I think it's really important as a scientist not to put a belief system first. The whole point is to explore the unknown.
Come explore with us. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Tomorrow at 1 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from U.S. Venture, dedicated to having a people-first culture, with a commitment to giving back to communities locally and globally. Information is available at usventure.com. Finding a better way.
Support comes from the Choral Arts Society, presenting its 32nd annual Lessons and Carols concert Saturday, December 7th, 7 p.m. at First Presbyterian Church in Racine. Listen, sing along, and share the holiday spirit through this tradition of music and spoken word. Tickets at choralartsonline.org.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. At 8:44, here's what's happening in news. At least two people were wounded by Israeli fire from by Israeli fire into southern Lebanon this morning, according to state media. However, the ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah is holding so far. That ceasefire requires for no fire within 2 months and also calls for Hezbollah to move north while Israel moves south. The Sawyer County Sheriff's Office in northwestern Wisconsin is asking for help from the public in identifying a suspect wanted for a string of fires started recently. 6 fires have been started in the past 10 days, according to the sheriff's office. And tomorrow's game between the Wisconsin Badgers and Minnesota Golden Gophers at Camp Randall Stadium could be one of the coldest at Camp Randall in decades. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Schwab, with Schwab investing themes like artificial intelligence, renewable energy, or pet passion. Over 40 themes to invest in. Learn more at schwab.com. From C3 AI. C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to traceable, hallucination-free insights from enterprises using any LLM, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. This is Enterprise AI. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz.
And I'm Amy Martinez. Now, I know a lot of us like to watch football on Thanksgiving, but what about if that is not for you? Well, if you're a movie lover and looking for something holiday-related, we've got some suggestions for you from Brandy Victorian. She recently wrote a piece for The Hollywood Reporter entitled 36 Thanksgiving Movies to Feast on This Season. Hello, Brandy. I didn't know there were 36 Thanksgiving movies to start off with.
It was quite a big search, I have to tell you that, to find them.
Since Thanksgiving is one of those days when lots of families will be coming together, what are some of your favorites for family viewing of all ages?
I think we have to start with Miracle on 34th Street, which I know is all about Santa, but it starts on Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, which is the biggest celebration of the holiday. And I think it's also a beautiful way to usher in Christmas. This is multi-generational, so that's at the top of my list.
Your beard doesn't have one of those things that goes over your ears.
Well, that's because it's real, just like I'm really Santa Claus.
Another one for me is What's Cooking. This is 2000, but I think it's just such a great story. There's these 4 different families who come together, a Vietnamese family, Latino family, Jewish, African-American, and they share a Thanksgiving meal, each one having their own unique take on those classic Thanksgiving dishes. But we know this holiday is all about food. It's all about family. It's all about sharing. And so I think this is a great one.
All right, you've also got some animated films on your list, Free Birds and Garfield's Thanksgiving. So tell us about those two.
Yes. Free Birds, just a hilarious duo. Woody Harrelson, Owen Wilson voicing these 2 turkeys. And essentially, they go back to the very first Thanksgiving and try to change the course of history so that they don't get eaten on Thanksgiving Day.
Okay, what's inside this secret base anyway?
A time machine.
A time machine?
A time machine.
So that's a very cute, funny film. And as you mentioned, Garfield, I mean, this is going back to the classic comic strip we all know, so very nostalgic. And also, I have to throw in a Charlie Brown Thanksgiving. It's all in the name there with the title from 1973.
Now, the movies you've mentioned have that direct link to Thanksgiving that we can kind of feel and see and hear.
Yes.
What about other non-traditional movies on your list that might nod to the holiday in some way?
Yeah, I'm going to start with Rocky, since you mentioned about sports. I mean, this at least gets us into sports in some way. And this film gave us that classic line, to you it's Thanksgiving, to me it's Thursday. So I think that's one we can add, a personal favorite. For mine is Addams Family Values. I might still have a little Halloween in me, but in this one we see Wednesday and Pugsley off at Camp Chippewa, and they enact this play of the first Thanksgiving, which is sort of fun.
The gods of my tribe have spoken. They have said, do not trust the pilgrims, especially Sarah Miller. Gary, she's changing the words.
Also, I'm going to throw in You Got Mail, Funny People, Instant Family. All of these movies have just fantastic Thanksgiving scenes.
Yeah, Sleepless in Seattle gets all the pub for being a Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan movie, but You Got Mail is right up there for me. In fact, for me,
absolutely,
it even surpasses it. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And I guess for a lot of these movies on your list, I mean, if someone wanted to, they could just like start them in the morning and have them on a loop all throughout the day. It's kind of almost like background holiday music in a way, except in movie form.
Exactly. 100%.
All right, that's journalist Brandy Victorian. Her work appears in The Hollywood Reporter. Brandy, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. I don't know about you, but that music definitely brings up some memories of Snoopy trying to fight the chairs as he sets up for Thanksgiving. It's Morning Edition here on WPR. Got about 11 minutes left in the hour now. I know we have a lot of readers who listen to this program, and we're going to hear a story in a little bit about the comeback of Barnes & Noble. That's just a couple of minutes away here on WPR.
You can now hear WGTD's Noon Tunes on the third Saturday of every month at 10 a.m. Noon Tunes is where we highlight and we celebrate the local musical talent in southeastern Wisconsin by playing their music for you on the radio. So if you or someone you know is a musical artist who wants to be on Noon Tunes, call me, Dave McGrath, at 262-564-3880 or email me at mcgrathd@gtc.edu. We'll get you on.
On Wisconsin Public Radio. In sports, the Packers are playing today. The Green Bay Packers are currently sitting at third place in the division with a record of 8-3. They will host the Miami Dolphins tonight at 7:20. And the Wisconsin Badgers play tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. They're going to be taking on the Minnesota Golden Gophers. The Badgers need a win in order to qualify for a postseason bowl game. They've made a postseason bowl game in the past 22 seasons. The Wisconsin Badgers women's volleyball team got a win last night over Ohio State. They have one game left in the regular season now against Michigan State on Saturday. And the Milwaukee Bucks have won 7 of their last 8 games. They will also be playing on Saturday against the Washington Wizards. And weather mostly cloudy across the state today. A few flurries are possible in the afternoon with high temperatures in the 20s and 30s, lows down to the teens and 20s overnight. It's WPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz. Barnes & Noble was once the biggest of its kind. Then it fell to the brink of extinction. Now this bookseller has its own plot twist. It's expanding once again. NPR's Alina Seluk reports, and a note, this story has been updated for today's broadcast. It was originally reported in March of last year.
The ghost of Barnes & Noble past meets the spirit of Barnes & Noble future in a single shopping center.
I'm kind of cutting across this small parking lot to go from the old shut-down Barnes & Noble to the recently opened Barnes & Noble.
Both in Pikesville, Maryland.
It's really quiet in here, which makes sense. It's a bookstore.
Not quite a library, but close. I'm here to check out the chain's makeover. Inside is lit up and bright, with bookshelves arranged not in rows of alphabetical stacks, but in little thematic rooms so people linger and browse and maybe find something they didn't know they wanted.
Games, puzzles, travel are all in kind of a little nook. There's like a whole nook of manga, another nook of books for young readers, graphic novels.
Everything you see in the store will be brand new.
Janine Flanagan heads up store planning and design at Barnes & Noble, and she's been busy. After years in survival mode, the chain opened 31 new stores last year and 61 this year, returning to places it had abandoned and even taking over former Amazon bookshops.
I would say probably 2006, 2007 was the last time we opened this many stores.
Barnes & Noble slowly collapsed through the 2010s. What once was an archetypal big box villain to independent bookstores became lunch for Amazon. Its online store lagged behind, while its physical stores got overrun by gadgets and blankets and stuff in pursuit of any kind of sale.
We sort of went off the rails, I think, a little bit, and we got away from who we were as booksellers.
Then in 2019, Barnes & Noble was bought by a hedge fund, which is often a scary development. But it brought along a new CEO, James Dond, who was famous for leading what seemed like a miraculous turnaround of a British book chain called Waterstones. He pushed for Barnes & Noble stores to, quote, weed out the rubbish, and the biggest change actually borrowed from the playbook of independent bookshops, giving the local stores much more authority to order what their readers in their area want to see.
Which is a huge shift, frankly, in philosophy.
Shannon DeVito is the senior director of books.
It's not an algorithm. It's very much a, I read this, I loved it, I know this area, really gravitates towards beekeeping books. So I'm going to create the best beekeeping display I can.
The timing of all this proved extremely opportune. Barnes & Noble took advantage of pandemic lockdowns to renovate and recalibrate. Retail bankruptcies created cheaper space for new stores. And the chain relaunched right when people were buying more books than ever. Barnes & Noble does not disclose financials, but DeVito told me the company's sales have grown consistently for 3 years straight. That's big in Barnes & Noble land. Q expansion and new stores, like the one I visited, where several shoppers told me coming here was an alternative to waiting on an Amazon order.
I do like independent stores, but there's not a lot in this area, I don't think, so.
Kendra Wallace and her friend Andriana Pitzwright said they did notice the nice new interior, but remain skeptical of a big box chain trying to grow a bigger heart.
They're trying to capture the more intimate, independent bookstore feel when it's still just a Barnes & Noble. Feels a little staged.
And yet you did walk away with something.
Yeah, I'm a reader, so I enjoy picking up books wherever I can find them. Should I have bought more books for my collection? Probably not, but it is what it is.
Barnes & Noble may not have sold them on its new identity, but it did sell them some books. Alina Selyuk, NPR News, Pikesville, Maryland.
As jack-o'-lanterns are swapped for jingle bells, many pumpkins end up in landfills where they generate climate-warming methane gas. More than 1.5 billion pounds of pumpkins in the U.S. every year. Now, there are some creative alternatives to divert this holiday waste. Montana Public Radio's Alice Julin reports.
On a foggy morning in Missoula, Montana, about a dozen black and pink pigs at Turner Farms look on while a small dump truck pulls up alongside their pen. Slowly, the bed tips up and smashed jack-o'-lanterns tumble onto the ground as the dump truck pours out its load for the pigs to feast. The pigs dive right in to enjoy the orange bounty collected as part of the 6th annual pumpkin reharvest. Most of the pumpkins grown in the U.S. are used for decoration. Only 15% are processed for food. So as the festivities of fall give way to winter, most of those once-beloved porch pumpkins are thrown away. According to the EPA, food waste makes up 24% of all municipal solid waste in landfills nationwide. Farmer Ethan Turner is happy to accept this reharvest.
Pumpkins are a phenomenal feed source, particularly this time of year as we're gearing up for the winter.
Pumpkins are rich in vitamins and probiotics, kind of like kombucha for pigs.
And then on the backside, when they come out the back end of the cow or the pig, it's phenomenal soil for us next year.
Reharvests like this one have popped up across the country. There's even a Pumpkins for Pigs program where interested farms nationwide can sign up to receive local food waste. In a landfill, food doesn't decompose the way that it would outside or in a compost bin. Without sunlight and oxygen, food breaks down slowly and releases methane instead of carbon dioxide. Methane is a particularly potent greenhouse gas. A head of lettuce takes 2 to 4 weeks to break down in a compost pile. But in a landfill, it can take 25 years. For something as big as a carving pumpkin, it can be even longer. Pigs devour them quickly. Missoula's reharvest so far has kept 4,000 pounds of pumpkins out of the landfill this year. Turner Farms will continue to take food drop-offs like this through the winter. For NPR News, I'm Ellis Julin in Missoula, Montana.
Later today on All Things Considered, the science behind an extraordinary act of selflessness, the act of donating a kidney to a complete stranger. What makes someone more likely to do that? Listen live on the NPR app or on your local station. Hey, it could be a great conversation starter for your Thanksgiving table. And happy Thanksgiving from all of us here on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz.
And I'm Alex Crow. I say it all the time, but you never know what you're going to get here on Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm wishing very happy Thanksgiving to you and yours, and thanks for making us a part of it here at WPR. News is on the way.
Support for WPR comes from Wild Birds Unlimited Madison, celebrating their 38th anniversary on November 22nd and 23rd. Open daily from 10 to 6, close Sunday. Discover a refuge in your own backyard.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center and the Alzheimer's Association offers a monthly memory cafe. It's held the second Tuesday of each month from 1 until 2 p.m. Call 800-272-3900.
This is WGTD HD 91.1 Kenosha Racine.